today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 107, we'll be reimagining Japan as a new book examining the future of the country is released.
Getting this number of people to speak out for change is pretty unusual. I think that this is more of the beginning than really the end, and people at this point are really using this as a rallying cry for some of the larger issues that the country's facing.
That was Brian Salzberg, partner at McKinsey & Company and executive editor of Reimagining Japan. And staying in the region, we'll be asking what playing host to the 2018 Winter Olympic Games means for South Korea.
Korea having the Olympics for itself, the Summer Olympics, was one real landmark for South Korea, and you saw a lot more confidence after that. You'll see more of this with the Winter Olympics. I think it's really a very good thing for Korean industry.
That was Gwen Robinson of the Financial Times Tokyo Bureau, and later in the program, we'll be spotting new business opportunities in Athens with our correspondent, Kimberly Bradley.
I went to the culture minister's home on Sunday morning, and he was very honest. And the photographer got up at the end of the interview and he said, "You've redeemed my trust in what Athens could be. Thank you." I think it's part of the public sector's job to regain the trust of the people.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, July 10th, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London with me, Tyler Brulé, and my colleagues, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound. I'm back. Did you notice?
Welcome. Yes, we saw you coming through the door.
Just in studio, or did you? I know I was in the office all week. Did you know that?
I saw you coming through the door of the office.
That's good.
You knew you were here.
Yeah.
I've seen you around.
I've seen you as well.
I've seen you.
I'm seeing a lot of you today.
Don't do this again. Because I did it for the, you know.
What?
Your hairy chest.
Yeah.
All right, here we go.
No, it's fine. I mean, listen, this is the beauty of radio. It's the beauty of your chest.
But maybe if you pulled some hair out, you could donate it to Tyler because he's got one shaved knee. Yeah. We could do a hair transplant.
Weird. I like that.
It's strange.
Yeah, that would be. Could you imagine?
Do you think it matches up? Show me your knee.
I think you're sort of a bit sort of, you know, you're a bit sort of blondie ready.
It's not red. Come off.
Is it? What's wrong with
no, it's not. I think bits of it would work.
It's like my hair. It's like my head hair. It's the same colour. It's not sort of red.
It's a bit of a remarkable Sunday today, isn't it?
Yes. Well, it's the final day for one of Britain's newspapers. But
one of the highest circulation English language newspapers in the world. And I imagine we're one of the most profitable. That it was announced on Thursday that this is it for the news of the world.
And just, you know, obviously the background to this is extraordinary, ongoing and impossible to dampen down story about phone tapping and phone hacking in the UK, where journalists systematically were employing private investigators to listen to people's private messages on their answer phones, on their mobile phones. And at the first, this seemed to be just a celebrity story. And that, I think, the people were generally interested in. They thought it wasn't a great thing. But it's now kind of turned out that these investigators were tapping to the phones of the bereaved, of people who were murder victims, of the families of soldiers who've been killed. And just suddenly, in a few days, this story, you know, it just went extraordinary. Everybody realized it was enormous.
Yeah. Rob, just on the timing of this, though, as well, because there has been a lot of discussion around the fact that, of course, News Corp, who are, of course, the parent company of the paper, they have a not insignificant share of B Sky B, who I didn't realize were actually the biggest television company in the UK, and of course are looking to take the whole thing over. Now, I would imagine that in the offices of various communication ministers and junior ministers, this was being looked at very hard. And I'm just wondering how strategic a move is that there was no choice but to either, you know, close it, offload it somehow, because there was going to be no possible takeover.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that is the thing that they're wanting to protect the most. I mean, I remember when this happened on Thursday, that was our immediate thing, was that this must be to protect that. And they obviously feel that there is more money to be made and more longevity in Sky as a TV brand and the News of the World as a piece of paper that arrives on your doorstep every Sunday. Not maybe on yours. Or on mine,
or
actually.
Or maybe on yours. But Andrew gets sort of the full stack,
Andrew won't be lighting a fire this winter. What are you going to use?
No, but it's funny because I think that the News of the World, maybe not now, but some years ago, there were lots of people who actually took, you know, they would take the Sunday Times and the News of the World. You know, they'd like a bit of highbrow and lowbrow. It was, you know, the kind of, you know, catching out the vicar sleeping with one of his parishioners or something. That was the kind of stuff of, you know, the News of the World 20 years ago. And now suddenly it's kind of got into kind of much more kind of busting, you know, celebrities for drugs and God knows what. But it's been a campaigning newspaper that's kind of lost its way.
I also wonder how, you know, what in News International's mind, you know, how important they want to keep everything from the Wall Street Journal to the Times as well, kind of clean, you know, from this, away from this, you know, because it becomes Murdoch and it becomes News Corp and it becomes something that you feel is a very top-down kind of piece of sort of, you know, a piece of dry rot that comes right from the top. Do you know what I mean?
Andrew, because that's, I mean, as a Fleet Street veteran in your time, we brought you to safer pastures. But how much of this was, as Robert was saying, you know, is it a defensive move as well to say, okay, let's just try to stem this because, okay, if you've got major automotive brands, if you have, you know, listen, you know, a lot of your top advertisers, you know, pulling out of the News of the World, of course, it's going to hit your other, you know, domestic papers in the UK. But then, you know, does it eventually sort of, you know, jump across the Atlantic to the Wall Street Journal?
Yes, I'm not sure if it would jump to the Wall Street Journal, but I think here within the UK, there's a, you know, there's a sense that people are looking at News Corp as, you know, as one institution that they're buying their advertising from. So you can imagine a UK advertiser might be reluctant to kind of advertise, you know, in Associated newspapers. So The Sun, for example, hasn't been caught up in this in the same way. But you would imagine that people associate the two newspapers in their minds, so suddenly they'll stop putting their advertising in The Sun as well. So, yeah, they've made a giant sacrifice. They've kind of knocked down a building in the way of a fire, as it were, to kind of make this kind of break and hope that something will stem this kind of terrible tide of daily stories about what a useless, you know, terrible kind of newsroom they run.
And on that note, I mean, you're talking about, I mean, this is not a small Sunday operation. I mean, this is, you're talking hundreds of journalists. And then, of course, all of the affiliated commercial and distribution staff that go along with them as well. Are they, you know, all given marching orders, or do you think that they are temporary? And I don't want to be sort of overly cynical about this, but, you know, are they temporarily sort of, you know, redeployed to other departments? And do we, in a month's time, come January, that we see, you know, The Sun suddenly has a Sunday edition? Are they really sort of walking out of sort of the red top Sunday game for good, do you think?
No, I can't imagine they will, because, you know, that you begin to give up so much territory to, you know, the Daily Mail and to the Express, and suddenly you're making their businesses profitable and kind of denying yours the kind of that kind of lifeline of cash and of readers. I would imagine they will find some way to reinvent a newspaper that allows them to remain within that territory, but that is seen as completely clean, that it has, you know, a new set of kind of hands at the top, and that there's no kind of links with the past.
Mm. Rob, what do you think that there's then for, you know, the other ones who are left out there? It's certainly not, you know, the same in terms of scale, but then, you know, if you look at something like, you know, another paper like the Daily Star, for example, does this also mark the end of dirty journalism, as it were, or let's say certainly less clean journalism in this country?
Well, it's weird, actually, because the Daily Star's Sunday edition, the Sunday Sport, went out of business. Mm. And it's weird, as we're talking about the most, surely the most profitable Sunday newspaper, and therefore the most profitable newspaper, certainly in this country, that disappearing. And I mean, obviously its competitors must be jumping up and down with glee, you know, the Sunday Mirror and the People and... What else is
there?
I guess the Mail on Sunday, yeah. I suppose, as well. You know, these are the people that kind of share a similar territory to it. Must be kind of going bananas. But I suppose the Sunday Times probably kind of relieved that, as I said before, they're not being sort of, if not dragged down with this ship, they're not taking on any unhealthy ballast.
Mm. I mean, would an analyst be looking at this right now and saying, well, you know, actually, okay, bad for the brand that it happened at this time, but you know, there was going to be sort of the, you know, there's going to be a decline anyway. You know, do you really even want to be, you know, we've talked about, yes, the power of Sunday newspaper, weekly newspapers are going to be around for some time still, but, you know, it's probably just as well you're out of the business now anyway.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is, you know, that there are lots of repercussions here. I think that what you can't control is what the public thinks. And, you know, we've seen in the UK in the past, for example, when many people died in Liverpool in the football terrible tragedy where people were crushed to death and The Sun reported it badly. You know, a city turned against a newspaper and they turned against a publisher. And I think that could happen here, where you're seeing cases now. If they've been tapping the phones of dead soldiers and if they've been tapping the phones of murder victims, then suddenly you get this kind of feeling that, you know, a whole culture can turn against you. Mm. And again, that's why I think they have to make this massive sacrifice, because that can last for years. Your brand, then it does begin to kind of affect your whole brand. You're seen as poisoned. You know?
Rob, do you think that someone else moves into that territory? So, you know, let's say, I mean, Andrew, you do believe that the News International will get back into the game, and they probably will launch another Sunday newspaper. But, you know, at a time when no one really wants to be buying newspaper presses, Rob, you know, would you see... Yeah, I mean, you know, does the Mirror say they're going to even launch another parallel title? You know, what might happen?
I wonder. I mean, I think that is a possibility. I also think it might be an interesting test of how how seriously News International takes the internet and web publishing, having, you know, the paywalls on their other titles. It's interesting to see how successful they are and whether they'll try and ramp that out. It's also a fact that this sort of journalism, calling it that, is much more prevalent in web-only publications. Mm. TMZ, for example, the kind of ultimate celebrity gossip column online, you know, makes huge revenues and is run by a man that's trained as a lawyer for a reason. And I think that it might be maybe that there is something that they'll do in a similar vein to that. Keep the news to the news and keep the gossip online. You know, there are clearly far more legal loopholes online than there are in the vaguely regulated press, at least, that they're operating in before.
But Andrew, certainly on a revenue side, and also when you look at it demographically, though, I mean, this is still a paper play. I think when you want to reach a lot of, you know, the audience that the News of the World is targeting in this country, it's not online.
No, it's not online. And I think also what's interesting is that actually many of the News of the World readers, for good or bad, are not probably natural kind of internet users. They're people who are reading it on a Sunday, first of all. So many people don't want to be around a screen on a Sunday. It's not like your daily content in, say, the Daily Mail. People are reading it, you know, in bars and pubs and things. So it still needs to be a print operation, I think, for the Sunday.
Mm. We should probably turn to print of a different kind. A visionary new book out this week takes a comprehensive look at what action Japan needs to take in order to overcome both its recent disasters and future challenges. Reimagining Japan, the quest for a future that works, collates essays from over 80 thinkers around the world and gives a candid and creative vision for the country. Brian Salisbury, partner at McKinsey & Company, is executive editor of the book, and he joins us on the line now from Tokyo. Hello, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I guess it was probably about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, that I was contacted by one of your other collaborators about the fact that the book was going to be happening, and thank you for also allowing me to contribute to it. I guess just, you know, given everything that has happened, I'm wondering, you know, how much did you have to reimagine from where you started when you first had the idea to this book to what is now hitting bookshelves now?
Yeah, well, coincidentally, the book was due at the publisher and being transmitted to the publisher on March 11th, just about an hour before the earthquake struck here in Tokyo, where we were. So we, of course, spent about a week after that trying to figure out how the situation would resolve itself here, and there was a lot of unknowns then and still some now. So what happened was we basically decided that the book as is could not go to press, but at the same time, you know, the fundamental challenges Japan is facing have not changed. So what we ended up doing was, I would say, about 25% or 30% of the authors and the content had to be revised. I wouldn't say changed, but revised. And then we added an upfront section of the book, and the book is now positioned as Japan facing two emergencies: the short-term emergency around the nuclear crisis and rebuilding from the tsunami, but then broader long-term emergency that covers a lot of the other fundamental issues facing the country.
How much would you say the tone changed? Because certainly I would think that there must be, you know, a number of contributors, and it's quite an extraordinary, you know, list when you look at the likes of Mr. Arnault or someone like Tadashi Inai, the chairman of Fast Retailing, in brackets, Uniqlo, also contributing to the mix. I mean, was there quite a strong call to action that Japan had to wake up anyway, and or not in the original versions?
Yeah, so surprisingly, there really was a strong wake-up call for Japan, and I think this situation just gave people more of a reason to act more quickly. I mean, the Prime Minister Kan said a couple of days after the earthquake, you know, this was a time to reinvent Japan. And in actuality, though, the title of the book, Reimagine Japan, was in place prior to the events of March 11th. And most of the call to action really was there. So I think what really happened was people went back and wanted to put the earthquake and everything in context of what they were saying. But the messages were strong before, and the problems that they were citing remain. Mm.
If you look at, I guess it's some, you know, over 70, you know, different essays that have been penned. When you look at the tone of what is there, and then also the fact that you've just hit bookshelves over the last week or so, what's the reception been in Japan so far by both the Japanese media or Japan Incorporated? I would say.
You know, it's only been out for a week, but it's exceeded our expectations really on every dimension. The book right now is the best-selling book, both in English and Japanese, for nonfiction books on Amazon Japan, which is the largest bookseller there. And the dialogue and buzz amongst some of the people you mentioned is great. You know, we have a big launch event coming up next week, and in fact, you know, the number of both government people and business people and even professors of schools that have decided to attend to hear what this is about has been tremendous. So both in Japan and then, frankly, outside of Japan, the interest in Japan and this topic of reinventing, rebranding, and reimagining Japan is as great as it's been in a very long time.
Mm. In the weeks that I was in Tokyo after the earthquake and tsunami, there were certainly a lot of gatherings where you had, you know, people at a government level and you know, but I think more so the private sector really pulling together, you know, not just in terms of direct aid action, but also, you know, thinking long term and short term as well in terms of what could be done, primarily from a motivational, you know, let's keep this whole thing going. Do you still feel there's that same sense of urgency? Because, you know, so often after a major crisis, you know, you do go into also this slightly sort of flat period because, you know, either the world goes back to normal in so many respects or other events take over. And I'm wondering, what is the mood right now in terms of truly reimagining what's happening there?
You know, I think there's not a loss of momentum and enthusiasm and commitment. And in fact, I think it's greater. I've only been in Japan 4 years, but people that have been here longer will tell you that, and as you know from your experience, that getting this number of people to speak out for change is pretty unusual. And between what we're seeing with protests around the nuclear situation and figures like Tadashi and I, who you mentioned, like SoftBank's Sonsan, like Mikitani-san of Rakuten, the largest internet company in Japan, all being more and more vocal about this need for change. So I think that this is more of the beginning than really the end, and people at this point are really using this as a rallying cry for some of the larger issues that the country's facing.
And from a global perspective, what happens with the book beyond the shores of Japan?
So our primary objective was to start a constructive dialogue in Japan, but outside of Japan, we're just seeing a huge amount of interest. So the book itself will be available in selected distribution in markets like, of course, the U.S. and London and some of the other markets in Asia. We're seeing a huge interest, particularly in markets like Singapore and Dubai, where there's just a fascination with the country. And I think, frankly, some of the lessons here are lessons that any developed country can learn from, because in some ways, you could argue that Japan could be viewed as a bellwether for some other emerging nations that are no longer in their growth phase and facing some of the challenges like demographics and aging, and as well as energy challenges. And many other countries may be able to learn from some of the insights in the book.
Great. Brian Salzberg from McKinsey & Company, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tyler.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Now, also on the line from Tokyo was the woman who was also charged with chasing my copy and also having to reform it. Gwen Robinson from the Financial Times is on the line. Hi, Gwen.
Hi.
Gwen, just you know, on that point, and I think you were obviously listening in when we were chatting to Brian, we've been, of course, checking in with you periodically, you know, since the events of the great earthquake. And I'm wondering, does that chime with you as well? I mean, is there that same sort of momentum issue? Because I also hear a lot from readers as well who spend time in Japan saying it still feels, you know, incredibly down, not very buoyant. But, you know, could that also just be the challenge of summertime in Japan more than anything else?
Well, that's a very good point, Tyler, because as well, we do have this huge issue about the power cuts as well, which kind of tends to depress things. And people are still trying to conserve power. So you've got lights being dimmed and a lot of power running at half mast. And some companies have even started changing to a four-day week or running their week from a Sunday through to a Thursday. So it's not much fun if you have to work a Sunday suddenly to keep your job. So, you know, it's very mixed. I mean, on the other hand, you'll go out in an evening like I was the other night and you can see restaurants absolutely packed. Other times you'll walk into a very popular restaurant and you'll be empty. So it really seems to be very patchy at the moment. And I think, you know, as well, this is the view from Tokyo, where both Brian and McKinsey's based and a lot of the writers and commentators are based. But in East Japan, that's the situation. But West Japan, where you've got Kyoto and the rest of the country, it's quite a different feeling. I think there's more a sense of immediacy here in Tokyo that Fukushima, the troubled nuclear plant, and the whole Tohoku region and all its problems in the aftermath of the tragedies, you know, that's the mood there, and you feel it much more in Tokyo.
Gwen, it's Andrew here. In the discussion earlier, there was this idea that Japan is actually quite ready for change. But when you look at kind of TEPCO and many of these other companies, there seems to still be a kind of very old-fashioned corporate structure in Japan, often, that is very hard to make malleable, to kind of adapt to a new world. Do you think that Japan really is ready for change?
Well, I agreed with what Brian said, actually, about how the signs and some of the circumstances and conditions were there well before the earthquake, but what you've got now is kind of greater momentum. So the pressures are building. I mean, never TEPCO, the power company operating the nuclear plant, has been able to operate for years with no one putting this kind of pressure on. So what it's done, as Brian said, was really catalyse, in a way, a wake-up call. So I think there's a lot of debate now about changes that are needed in government and in business. And so companies really are thinking about things. But also when they're suddenly confronted with things like the Great Japan, the, you know, industrial powerhouse, being crippled by power shortages, and big companies suddenly having to evaluate whether they can go to a four-day week and how they can conserve power, simple things like that. That tends to alter somebody's mindset, and I think a lot of corporate bosses have also been rethinking a lot of things. And as well, you know, a lot of companies are thinking of expanding offshore. They've had to take another look at this shrinking, stagnant domestic market, and it's all come together. So I think, really, you know, that whole shock of the tragedy has catalyzed these kind of thoughts that might have been there before.
Just going back to the book quickly, when something like this hits bookshelves in Japan, and it's also, okay, yes, there are a number of Japanese voices in the book, but it's come from an American multinational like McKinsey. How receptive are Japanese ears, corporate, also journalists? How much do they sit up and listen? Are they listening, you know, 1 week in?
Well, that's also a very good point. But because of the nature of the way this book was done, published by a big Japanese company, Isshō Gakukan, with an English language version and a Japanese language version, it's quite interesting that I think, particularly here, the Japanese are very receptive to authoritative voices, or who they perceive to be authoritative, and that includes both foreigners and Japanese. So when you've got big names like the ones that have penned some of these essays, or interesting views from names that are possibly not so big but making very good points that maybe get aired, like there's a lot of publicity with some of the essays that have been done and points that have been made, then I think it's not really seen as a McKinsey book. It's not even necessarily seen as a Isshō Gakukan book, the name of the Japanese publisher. It's just seen as, these people are interesting, I want to read their view. And I think we're seeing a bit of that. And Japanese have taken some of these points and debated them. There's such an interesting range of topics and points being made, far beyond just rebuilding Japan. And only a third, as Brian said, of the essays do sort of address directly that kind of challenge.
Mm. Gwen, just before we go, I just want to just change topic, but certainly stay in the neighborhood. We saw South Korea awarded the 2018 Winter Olympics with Pyeongchang finally getting their chance, and you saw this, you know, extraordinary euphoria across the sea. Of course, a good thing regionally, but do you think also that that Japan also is able to take some delight in this because they hope there's going to be a residual effect, or is it also sort of seen as, God, you know, there goes Korea again, continuing to sort of, you know, march forward as this, you know, extraordinary national brand?
Yes, there's always, I mean, that sense has been building, particularly in recent years. It's always been a slightly fraught relationship. But I think in this particular case, Japan knows it had the Winter Olympics in Nagano many years ago. You know, they've co-hosted the World Cup football. And in this particular case, I haven't really seen any kind of outpourings of envy or resentment. On the other hand, you don't really get the, you know, this is so jolly, they're right next door and it's great for the region. I think Japanese at the moment are very much focused on themselves and the challenge ahead of them. So it's hard to read that at this point. But I'm sure they're very obsessed with their own performance in these Olympics. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of interest in actually, you know, being part of that and having it right next door.
Mm. Just going back to the Korean momentum, mm. and of course an area that you've covered a lot is, okay, fine, 2018 is a long way off, but just, mm. do you think that there is then suddenly even a bigger halo effect for the likes of course, the Samsungs and the Hyundais and everyone else who makes, you know, up, you know, the Korean firm, as it were, is, you know, aside from sort of you know, being good news, do you think it also really sort of helps the corporate halo of South Korea?
Oh, definitely. And I think actually Korea having the Olympics for itself, the Summer Olympics, was one real landmark for South Korea. And you saw a lot more confidence after that. And companies managed to, particularly the commercial effect, sponsorships, their names up in lights. And you'll see more of this with the Winter Olympics. I think it's really a very good thing for Korean industry.
And finally, do you think it, I mean, we've already heard that Governor Ishihara wants to bid for 2020. And I guess go back to that maybe slight sort of sense of defeat. Do you think it's, does it bode well for Tokyo then for 2020 that they would then have the Summer Olympic Games so close by?
A lot of people are saying that Japan might stand to gain some kind of sympathy votes as well. We all know, I think, that in the whole sort of process of deciding these major things, such as who gets to host what in terms of Olympics and other big global events, that doesn't necessarily guarantee anything. And the fact that South Korea is right next door to Japan, I don't know if that augurs very well for Japan to land something just 2 years later. So I guess, you know, I would say it's anybody's guess, but, you know, it's not unrealistic to bid for it and have hopes for it. But as you say, Tyler, it's a long way off, so anything's possible.
Very, very true. Gwen, we look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks, and hopefully cooler weather will be hitting Tokyo by the time we get there. Thanks very much.
Yes, indeed. Get on over here and bring your battery-cooled jacket, which has just been launched here.
Okay, I think Andrew wants one more than me. Anyway, we'll see you soon, Gwen. Thanks very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in London. We're back in a moment. Back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's Culture Time with Robert Bound.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay, thank you very much.
We haven't heard a lot from you since the top of the show.
I know. I had a question for about Japan.
Which is?
But I didn't.
Which was?
It was a bit of a sort of curveball question.
Okay.
Well, I thought
that'd be interesting. You know why? That's a good question.
Well,
because there's a chapter. No, but I'm just saying that's a good question as a curveball question because there is an essay in here called Bend It Like Nakata.
Right. I like that.
Good. Anyway, what's the question?
Well, I wondered about, you know, how popular culture, manga artists, things like that in Japan have responded to what's happened in Japan recently. Because they're sort of like a mixture of the graffiti artists and the stand-up comedians who are always the quickest people to sort of pounce on national events.
Yeah.
I wonder what had happened. Because there's such a consciousness in Japan of,
and especially,
you know, Godzilla and all these monsters and these all came out of the nuclear fear. And I wonder whether that... whether something similar to that has come out.
And there was a series of really beautiful manga that were floating around the office, you know, very early when we launched, which was about a divided Japan due to, I think, earthquake and tsunami. And it was about sort of, you know, the north and south of Japan and how they were both at each other's throats. And so you also sort of wonder, I'm sort of thinking about, well, how long is sort of this passion period as well that, you know, people will be able to also maybe address sort of darker topics as well that surround this.
I think it's one of those things, it's a bit of a watershed, isn't it? Where lots of more truth comes out than you think.
Yeah.
You know, and it'll probably, and I wonder how it comes out in the culture. Well, maybe there's a story in that.
There might very well be.
Well, it could be a job for our new, kind of takeover person in Japan while Fiona's off having a baby, Kenji Hall. Give him a job.
Yeah.
Give him a mission.
Yeah. Right.
First week in the job.
Give Kenji a tickle. Has he officially taken over yet?
Yes. Fiona went on maternity leave on Friday.
Okay.
And Kenji Hall is place in Tokyo.
I think I'm going to arrive in Tokyo just in time for the delivery of the baby. What's if Fiona's mom said? She goes, we'd be there at the same time.
Okay, I'd
be at the hospital.
Midwife.
It's all right, I'm here now.
All right.
Anyway, well, I don't know how we go from one to the other.
to Beverly Knight.
Beverly Knight's back.
She is.
Can we put some echo on that, do you think? Beverly Knight's back with a record called Soul UK. I thought that's not a very good name for a record, but then I knew why.
Why?
Because it's an album of covers.
Okay.
And they are soul, but they're sort of interesting. They're sort of hip-hop-y, soul-y things, like Soul to Soul and things like that from like the 90s.
And, you know, for people who aren't familiar with Beverly Knight, because I know the name very well.
Yeah.
And I think she's, you know, from the time that I arrived on these shores, you know, definitely someone who I you know, heard on the radio and maybe on dance floors as well. Would I have heard on
yeah.
dance floors?
Yeah,
she's been remixed, but I think she's had this kind of R&B career, hasn't she? That she's the interesting thing is that it's just gone on for, as you say, for a long time. It's 20 years, and I think that the other interesting thing about her is that she's always been a kind of a quite an intelligent advocate of all different sorts of stories and issues. So she's managed to keep this career going. You know, when. You know, lots of other people would have had dips in their career and disappeared. I think she's interesting.
I think she's quite bright, and she's also kind of cool. She's kind of got a great set of pipes on her, which lend themselves to quite a lot of different sorts of projects. So she's guests on a lot of people's records, and everyone in the business seems to hold her in high esteem. So she always seems to sort of duet with lots of cool people.
I got Beverly Knight confused with somebody else because I was on the plane back from Pisa the other day, and
Gladys Knight.
What's in class?
That's not the Pips.
No, but I think this is one of Beverly Knight's sort of, you know, contemporaries.
Michael Knight from Knight Rider.
No, but if I would say that I saw a British black songstress and she had sort of a big sort of poofy do on top, who would that be?
A diva.
No, it wasn't a diva. Then I thought maybe it was a diva. But no, a diva had sort of more of an asymmetric haircut, didn't she?
Yeah, but it may have grown.
You won't have hope so. No, but and it was bothering me the whole flight.
Did you? Was it in the in-flight magazine or something?
It was in the in-flight magazine.
Someone had ripped out the caption to put their chewing gum on there.
And all the Queenie flight attendants on British Airways were like freaking out about it. And then when she went up to the washroom, she was like, you know, they're all asking for autograph. Do you know who it was?
I don't know who it was. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I had to send an email out to Alex and I said, now if I had described, you know, I think big sort of, you know, big in the 90s, hair pulled back, but then sort of like big sort of, you know, poofy sort of bobble thing on top of her head.
And that's how the small from MP.
Yes, exactly. See, that was it. So you got it. Very good.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, whereas she was from Manchester, Bev is Wolverhampton's finest.
Okay.
What else comes from Wolverhampton?
Oh, I know. What were they called? E17 or something?
No, they're from Walthamstow.
Oh, Walthamstow. Okay. But they sound Wolverhampton, Walthamstow. They sort of sound the same to me. I've never been to either. I'm just adjusting the volume here. Okay.
Can you stop producing the program?
I couldn't hear you. We're going self-op when we move to our new studios, Rob.
Oh, we?
Yeah, self-op.
I thought
studios.
That was good.
Yeah.
I thought that was a good idea. I probably live to regret that.
You didn't tell us, Rob. What else does come from Wolverhampton?
I don't know. I was asking Tyler. I know how well travelled he is in the UK. and he didn't let me down. He got it confused with Awesome. Okay.
True to form.
Is apparently nothing. You know, apparently nothing. It's by the Young Disciples, 1991. It's a great sort of hip-hop soul song. And on this, she collaborates with Glenn Scott and with Roots Maneuver. Popularity of invasion. Of arms called gentle persuasion. What have we learned from history?
I think it'd be quite a big number, this one.
Yeah,
this summer,
good. It's really good. The record's really good, actually, because it has all those things that you kind of forget how good they were the first time around, and they're really good.
I had visions of Rob sort of striding around with sort of one more button undone, and
oh yeah, I was going to
any sort of boxers and briefs on a Sunday morning. That's the kind of album it is, isn't it?
It is kind of album it is. Bev on the front is rather provocatively sitting on something that is, I don't know, it's a speaker or something, and that is making me feel very under another button about life.
Yeah, absolutely. She's in good form. I think she's just pulling on her boots. That's what's happening in that picture. Yeah. Now, if you look, because she looks like she's backing into the speaker a little bit, but she's not. She's just she's getting dressed.
Yeah, okay.
Just as you would.
Yeah.
Right?
On a Sunday morning, she's getting dressed.
Zipping on your boots.
Yeah. Anyway, so we like her, don't we? It's good.
Yeah, it's very nice. And Andrew, you know her quite well, don't you?
I don't know her quite well. I've met her a few times. Well, I'll reveal a slight handle. A friend of mine, Dave Wolf, has been connected with her career for many years. And so through him, I met her a couple of times and been to see her perform. And as you say, Robert, she's just one of those, you know, just really kind of artists that lots of people seem to have followed for many years and you know, are passionate about. And
yeah, she's super cool. She's good. She's hot on the front cover of her record, isn't she? One other thing.
What?
She does a song by Roachford on the record. Remember Roachford? He was great.
Yeah,
really good.
I think so. Yeah. So but I get that confused with Rochdale. And I, But I think, isn't Lisa Stansfield from Rochdale?
I think, yeah, that is.
Oh, look at you trying to show off your knowledge of the
UK. I feel like
UK.
I'm a sort of surrealist painting of pop Britain.
Can't say this is a nepotistic programme, can you?
It's not nepotistic.
Well, no, I'm saying, you know, friends of, you know, Beverly Knight's producer or manager, contributing to books for McKinsey, all of those things. It's all in the family, isn't it?
Yeah. Shall I tell you where my shirt was made?
We'll go to a break. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly in London. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. On last week's programme, our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield commented on what a future Greece might look like amidst its current crisis. In the meantime, we sent our writer, Kimberly Bradley, to Athens on an opportunity-spotting mission to find out the mood among local businesses, the building entrepreneurial spirit, and the municipal measures being taken to counteract the crisis. She joins us now on the line from Vienna. Hello, Kimberly.
Hello.
I read the copy earlier in the week. Very good story, which is going to be appearing in Monocle Mediterraneo on newsstands at the end of this month. The one thing that stood out was, you know, truly the opportunity spotters, and it's incredible, you know, given, you know, everything that we've seen over the past few weeks in Greece, that there have been, you know, clearly very sort of wily-eyed individuals who've been spotting the opportunity, not just, you know, over the past days, but have been, you know, methodically, as you pointed out, buying up derelict properties, you know, trying to certainly reinvigorate neighborhoods, amongst many other things that are happening. Do you see this as something which is just going to grow at the moment? In fact, that more people are going to pour in, you know, whether it's part of the Greek diaspora, other people from around the world who see that, you know, this is actually a great time to start reinvesting, not just in Athens, but the entire country.
I think we will see this. I think a few people in the city are just starting to dare to do things on their own, not just E.S. Ansakonis, you just mentioned, who's been buying up properties for about 10 years, but the Atenistas just started 9 months ago, and they already have 9,000 loose members. This is a group of activists that cleans up empty plots or plants gardens, helps people. 400 members are very active, but 9,000 are involved, and I think it's just going to gain momentum. I personally know of quite a few Greeks that have returned to the country within the past year to either just go home or to open up a gallery or to see what's really happening in their own country and do business from there.
I'm wondering how much was television, you know, as ever, was it distorting the picture? Because, you know, of course there was, you know, the camera lenses were trained on the rioting and the clashes that we saw. But, you know, at the same time, just the prevailing mood, there was some key characters that you interviewed for the story, but just, you know, the general mood, you know, what did you feel when you were there?
I actually expected it to be a war zone throughout the whole city. And the minute I got there, I could tell that these images that we've been seeing on the outside are very contained to about a 5-block space. And also, it was about a 2-day period. These riots recur, but the general mood is kind of business as usual as far as that really goes. It's tense. People are, they're waiting a bit to see what happens, but they're still living their lives. I would say it's just kind of a slight anticipatory mood, a little bit depressed here and there, but let's keep going.
Mm. I mean, one thing that we certainly heard, though, is that there was never this, you know, moment where the penny dropped. Perhaps now it has. And of course, everyone realizes that, okay, this is a time to, whether it's sort of, you know, pull up socks or whatever one does, you know, at a time of crisis like this. But now things really have to move forward. And I think when you spoke to some of the individuals in that story, some have clearly got that, and they've certainly been moving forward and pushing ahead for some time now. But is there that sense of also, I mean, really sort of a rallying cry, and that whether it's, you know, people at the top end of the private sector, that they know that, listen, that you can't rely on the government, we're just going to have to go and do this on our own?
I'm not so sure that that's really, you mean the private sector, not the public sector?
Yeah, the private sector.
Yeah. I would say so. I would definitely say so. I think the public sector is what's, they're running scared a bit. You know, the people that have lived fat or just never had, you know, they've had a job in name and never gone. I think a lot of the private sector people are also looking to do more international business. One thing that's holding them back a little bit are regulations that are going to need to fall away within the country. But a lot of these people have been waiting for this change for a while, and they see it as an opportunity rather than just a crisis.
I mean, as much as we might see, of course, you know, much of sort of the Greek diaspora, you know, returning because they spot the opportunity. Was there any sense, or was there any discussion that there also we might see this great exodus, or there might be a brain drain that the top, you know, financial minds, that you know, recent graduates, just think there's no hope here. And is that a discussion point?
It absolutely is. I heard it from two different people. I spoke to some architects the second day I was there who actually said that they would leave if the drachma came back. I mean, that they know that it won't, but that, you know, there's always a little bit of speculation about this. And the culture minister says that it's very high on the government's agenda to keep the young generation there. He sees it as the only hope that they have. And so they're taking various measures to make sure that there is opportunity, and this favoritism towards the older generation, which is really strong, you know, finally falls away. Yeah, I mean, people are nervous about this.
And is that part of the divide issue as well, that when they talk about sort of the younger generation, you mentioned the culture minister, at a ministerial level in government, do they realize that, well, okay, at least if we sort of look at a generation that's under 30, they're not looking for a future in the public sector, so we don't really have to worry about them. That's therefore we have to, you know, to maintain them and keep them away from the departure gates.
He said something. I mean, he said things to this effect. He also mentioned just throughout all the different areas of culture, you know, if you've got an entrepreneur, you've got to make sure that they have, you know, a decent tax structure with which they can do business. In tourism, for example, they're really trying to promote the young hoteliers. Universities need some money to provide research opportunities to people so they don't go elsewhere to do these things. They're aware of this. This government actually sounds like, you know, this particular minister, Pablo Ciarolanos, was educated abroad and has a pretty broad vision. I was very impressed.
Kimberly, it's Andrew here. I want to ask you, one of the things that I think you alluded to when we were speaking on the phone a little bit when you came back was that, in fact, this time of year, often Athens begins to completely empty out as people start heading for the beaches and going to the islands at the weekend. But actually, the city seemed physically busier, perhaps because people can't all afford to go away. But do you think there's a sense of people realising they need to kind of knuckle down and stay at work and start grafting a bit more?
I think it's a combination of that and simply not being able to afford to go away as much as they had been in the past. And that was actually discussed a couple of times with some friends of mine when we were out and about. The city was very full. It was also very fun. I mean, it was not a depressed mood in any way. You know, people were discussing the things that were happening. The riots were just over. But people were out and about and enjoying things the best they could and working hard, both.
which is, of course, you know, important to add. Just going back to when you talked about the culture minister and certainly an individual who is held within, you know, within high regard, and then also going back to sort of the friends you're out in the town with, do people sort of see or spy enough bright sparks in government that they think that there is, you know, enough effective leadership there, you know, who really know what to do and will be able to ensure that those grants are there for research at university, that there are going to be the right incentive programs for hoteliers, or is there a little bit of disillusionment with at least part of the current crop that's at the top of government?
I think there's a lot of mistrust. I think that's going to take some time to build. I can just give an anecdote. I went to the culture minister's home on Sunday morning with the photographer who's a young Athenian, and the interview was very nice, and he said wonderful things, and they were very broad, and he was very honest. And the photographer got up at the end of the interview, and he said, "I thought I'd come here and hear a lot of bullshit, and you've redeemed my trust in what Athens could be. Thank you." And I was kind of shocked at that. I thought, okay, the Athenians feel a bit disenfranchised. They don't really know who is governing them right now, but slowly I think that the public sector has to, I think it's part of the public sector's job to regain the trust of the people, and that'll take some time.
Kimberly, hi, this is Rob.
Hi.
We're talking about the culture minister. I wondered how central he is to the sort of rebuilding of the Greek brand, perhaps the Greek as a place to visit. Is culture quite high up on the agenda, not just the ancient stuff, but the amazing collections of people like Dakos Chanu and George Economou and the Acropolis Museum, which opened to much fanfare a couple of years ago? Are these seen to be key and vital to getting visitors to come and to galvanizing some sort of youth interest there?
They see it as such. He mentioned that they are a bit lower on the totem pole in the list of important ministries, but what they do has an incredible impact on how people see the country, and it very quickly gets multiplied. He's also the Minister of Tourism, so he has these two positions. Culture and tourism, of course, are very related. They are working on several different fronts. They've got a new initiative called Athens Every Week, where they create kind of a package that's meant for tourists to be able to better navigate the city. They have one focus each week as to activities that are on around the city. There is the Athens Festival, which I think is 2 years old, which brings in wonderful foreign acts as well as Greek, you know, music, theater, all kinds of things, and that lasts throughout a few weeks in the summer. That's been getting a lot of positive attention, and they're investing a lot of money into it. I think culture is very important in terms of the nation's image.
Great. Kimberly Bradley and Vieta, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was Kimberly Bradley, and you can read her piece in Monocle Mediterraneo on, I guess, a lot of the positive elements. And if you can sort of talk in terms of sort of green shoots, I think you do get to the end of your story, Andrew, and you think that, okay, there are the right forces there that can make it happen. I'm just wondering, do you find that there's been enough to sort of discussion as well about, of course, there has to be sort of belt tightening, and I think oftentimes we look at these situations, but, you know, has there been enough of a call to action in terms of what needs to happen at street level? I've sort of felt that's the message that's been missing. Okay, yes, it's going to hurt. There's going to be cuts. But then there hasn't been that sort of sense, okay, what are we going to do proactively? I don't know what your view is, Andrew.
Yeah, I don't think there is. I think the trouble is because, as you were saying, the kind of messages that get out through the news agenda are just really those riots. You see people throwing bricks and throwing smoke bombs, and that's kind of set the agenda. But what was interesting, I think, about Kimberly's story is that in a way we've seen the same thing when we've done these reports, you know, in Iceland, for example, after their crash, that you can't stop people. What happens is that there's a kind of going back to roots. There's a kind of sense that things should be a little bit more kind of Greek in their ambition. They shouldn't all be kind of international and kind of pastiches of things you see around the world. That they should kind of pull on their strengths. And the people that she meets, they seem to be doing that effortlessly. They seem to be saying, actually, real estate prices are down. We can rent a bigger space. We can actually start doing a company where we couldn't afford to do it a couple of years ago. I think for Greece, you know, which, you know, is a cliche, but a real one, is just this terrible problem of, you know, people not paying their taxations, terrible dodges all around. And until that is kind of, until people feel a kind of social responsibility about paying taxes, then you'll never change the culture of it. And that's the problem. So these things are great, but there needs to be a kind of cultural shift as well.
But it's not going to stop you from going to Mykonos, is it?
No, I'll be there. It would be interesting because, I mean, you know, Mykonos, you know, is obviously a very wealthy Athenian kind of playground. But I imagine that many wealthy Athenians, that they're earning their money in dollars and not particularly in euros and not particularly tied to exactly what's happening in the Greek economy.
It's not going to stop you from showing chest here, is it, Rob?
No, I mean, I'm going to probably be sporting a medallion as well when I reach the right hue of brown.
Exactly. We look forward to that. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back after this. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's almost time to say goodbye. But before that, here's Hugo MacDonald with this week's monologue.
Stylish Sam Cam invests in an Italian lighting classic for 10 Downing Street. This was the subject line of a press release sent out 2 days ago. Trite enough. Do I really care what the UK's First Lady has bought for her home? Caught in a fleeting moment of nosiness, I opened it nonetheless. What ensued was nothing short of a PR disaster. Stylish Sam Cam hasn't invested in anything Italian, or classic, it turns out. She has bought a £250 reproduction of the Castiglione brothers' 1962 Arco lamp from a company, Iconic Lights, specialising and proudly boasting that they reproduce classic designs at affordable prices. There is so much that's wrong with this entire episode, it's difficult to know where to begin the dissection. Copying classic designs is akin to theft. Using a blurb to describe the significance of the original design to sell the knockoff, which this press release did, mustering every possible cliche in the process, is closer to daylight robbery. Selling a story to the press that Samantha Cameron had invested in one is mind-bogglingly stupid and depressing. Iconic Lights, the name says it all, clearly saw an opportunity though. During the recent Obama state visit, 10 Downing Street released a shot of the Cameron's much-talked-about refurbished flat, which garnered more scrutiny and column inches than Obama's essential relationship declaration. Releasing pictures of their 30 grand refitted home was presumably a PR stunt, leading by example in David Cameron's call for an age of transparency. The press fell on the fact that the flat was done up with taxpayers' cash, though Downing Street was quick to say that no furniture or fittings had come from public funds, which were paid for from Cameron's own pocket. In it, we saw vague 1950s leanings. A walnut floor, a white Corian kitchen counter, and a mustard yellow sofa. There was also a box set of Desperate Housewives. But Cameron's government has also championed British craft and manufacturing as a means to grow the economy. This doesn't mean we expect every last thing in Number 10 to be British, though it could, and would be very nice if it did. But to neither Sam Cam nor the PR firm Iconic Lights called on to promote the purchase, most likely knocked up in China. See the disparity between her husband's messages and this steal. Is investing in good design, ethically manufactured, really too much to expect? There are other things that niggle. Sam Cam is the former creative director and now consultant for Smythson, a British brand that wears its Made in England heritage on its sleeve. How would she feel if any of Berlusconi's women were reported to be parading bargain reproduction Smythson bags as a badge of style? If it's really too much to fork out the £1,600 to buy a Floss Arco light, she could go on eBay where second-hand ones hover around half that price. Finally, though, an Arco light in a fairly small Georgian flat. It's not even an appropriate style choice. In Downing Street, for Monocle, I'm Hugo MacDonald.
Oh, dear. We really wound each other up over that one because I think Hugo was sitting in my office when that email came in. And as he said, it was just wrong on every single level. And I don't want to think, okay, you know, yeah, indirectly, it's probably, you know, it's all of our money anyway. But, you know, why are you going and buying a £250 crappy lamp?
I love Hugo's turning into sort of like the Brian Sewell of design, isn't he?
Yes, brilliant. Oh, bless him.
Yeah. He's quite a toughy old Hugo.
Yeah, he's amazing, isn't he?
Excellent. Well, that's all for this 107th edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills, and our sound engineer was Chris Sharp here at the Sound Company in London. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, including Hugo's rant about that lamp at 10 Downing Street, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. Remember to catch up with us daily via our Monocle column on our website. But for now, from London, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Bound.
Goodbye.